Hello and welcome to The Whole Health Cure, a space for trustworthy science-based information on how you can live healthier and longer through the way you eat, move, think, and recover. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, a physician, scientist, and lifestyle medicine pioneer with over 25 years of experience in patient-centered clinical care. Our conversation today is about managing menopause symptoms, and I'm joined by Dr. Michelle Tollefson, who's a lifestyle medicine expert and obstetrician gynecologist. She's a pioneer in women's health and lifestyle medicine and a professor at Metropolitan State University of Denver. She's the editor-in-chief of the textbook Improving Women's Health Across the Lifespan and co-authored Paving a Woman's Path Through Menopause and Beyond with Dr. Frades and Commander. Dr. Tollefson was one of the first physicians ever trained as a wellness coach. She's an international speaker, women's health consultant, mother to three kids, and a breast cancer survivor and thriver. Michelle, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm excited to be here with you today.
Yeah, Michelle, you've spoken nationally, internationally. I know you recently spoke at the American College of Lifestyle Medicine and are very passionate about the subject. And this is really personal as well as professional for you. Can you tell us a bit of how you got interested in this and your personal journey?
Sure. Oh, thank you so much. So I grew up with a pretty healthy lifestyle, but when I went to medical school and then did my OB-GYN residency, it was harder to eat those healthy meals and to get in enough physical activity. So when I got out of training and came back to private practice, I was really able to focus on lifestyle as medicine again. And then the more that I learned about nutrition and physical activity and stress management and sleep, I saw how the literature really supported its use for PMS, for fibromyalgia, for menopause, and many different conditions. So I shared that information with patients. They felt better. And it was almost like I had found a secret superpower in these healthy lifestyle behaviors. So 4.5 years ago, I was as healthy as I had ever been, no symptoms at all, and had a routine screening mammogram that made my life flip upside down. So on a routine screening mammogram, I got a breast cancer diagnosis. I had a 2-centimeter mass that was invading my chest wall that I fought with 16 rounds of chemotherapy going through early menopause. And then as soon as I finished chemotherapy, I had my ovaries removed and forever entered the menopause club. So it wasn't so much of a hormonal roller coaster as a hormonal crash. And being that I had estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, hormone replacement therapy was not an option for me, though I think it's a viable option for many women, but it wasn't for me. And so I really had to draw on the field of lifestyle medicine and use all that I could to help me personally with managing symptoms. And then also, it's been so powerful as well as rewarding to be able to share this information with breast cancer survivors who often go through early menopause or who are menopausal, as well as the general public. There was more research out there than I even knew about. So that's why I'm so passionate about lifestyle medicine and menopause and want to share this message.
Yeah, what a journey. And I think sometimes when you go through something like that, it's just such a challenging time. And to be able to take that knowledge, turn it into something that has made your life better and then share it with other people is really fantastic. When you went through that abrupt crash, if you will, what were the symptoms that you experienced?
So for me, it was sometimes hard to tell what were the symptoms that were going along with chemotherapy and what were the menopausal symptoms because they were overlapping. However, I did have the hot flashes. And so even though I wore mitts that we were trying to decrease the risk of peripheral neuropathy from the chemotherapy, but I would have hot flashes even while wearing these like chilling mitts. So hot flashes, night sweats, definitely problems sleeping. Some of that may have been from the anxiety of being treated for cancer, but I was definitely having more nighttime awakenings. Also, I had that brain fog. And so it was hard to tell, is this brain fog from chemotherapy or is this menopause related, as well as mood swings. So those were all things that I noticed. Also, while I continued to be physically active during chemotherapy treatment, I worked with a physical therapist and had a great team. I noticed my body composition start to change where I was really struggling to maintain my lean muscle mass and was starting to gain fat mass, even though my weight wasn't changing that much. And those are all things that we often see with the menopause transition. Of course, it's so different for each woman. The average age of menopause in the US is 51 years, but it's really that decade before, a woman's 40s into her early 50s, where we see so many menopausal symptoms. So for me, it was kind of like teasing apart what was menopause, what was chemotherapy related, but I definitely experienced a range of symptoms. And then as I got further out from chemotherapy, I knew that they more and more were likely to be due to menopause and not just the chemo.
Yeah. And Michelle, I think that a lot of people can identify with trying to figure out what part of the symptoms are menopause versus other things. Like you said, a lot of people have trouble sleeping. How much is just stress in their life and other components? How much is hormonal, and trying to differentiate that? As you got further along and you still had these symptoms, what did you do next?
So I really relied all that I could on the science around lifestyle medicine. And as I mentioned before, hormone therapy wasn't an option for me. So I really relied on the lifestyle medicine pillars. So nutrition. Dr. Neil Barnard with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine has some great research out. Yes, we would like larger studies, and I think those will be coming with time. But he had some great research showing that women who had a half cup of cooked soybeans a day, along with a low-fat, plant-predominant diet, that their moderate to severe hot flashes decreased by about 88%. And so I started to really incorporate soy daily. It was already part of my whole food plant predominant way of eating, but I started to really be mindful of getting 1 to 2 servings of whole or minimally processed soy a day, which is also beneficial for breast cancer survivors. So I really credit that with my significant reduction in hot flashes. I also looked at the literature, and so the healthy way I was already eating also, it supports fewer menopausal symptoms, vasomotor symptoms. And so people who eat a lot of dairy products or poultry typically have more vasomotor symptoms, as well as people who eat a higher fat and added sugar diet. So obviously that wasn't my style of eating. People who eat a more plant-forward diet, who eat more fruits and vegetables, typically have fewer menopausal symptoms. So I really have been fortunate not to be severely. My journey with hot flashes hasn't been as bad as I know many people's has, and I credit my healthy way of eating to most likely be part of that. Also, I'm very physically active, and the literature on physical activity and vasomotor symptoms, so hot flashes and night sweats, is kind of mixed. We sometimes don't know whether or not the fewer hot flashes are due to the actual physical activity or the resistance training, or if it's due to the changes in body composition. We know that women who are leaner, that they typically have fewer hot flashes and night sweats than women who are overweight. Also, really working on that stress management and sleep, those are things that can support us as far as vasomotor symptoms as well. So I think it's a combination of all of those different things. The research with the North American Menopause Society too lets us know that cognitive behavioral therapy can be supportive, and I've done some of that work as well. So there really is a toolbox. I think it's very reasonable for women who don't have an estrogen receptor positive breast cancer to talk with their gynecologist or their intern about the pros and cons regarding the use of hormone replacement therapy if they're struggling with vasomotor symptoms, but then also to embrace the lifestyle medicine behaviors that you talk about with your guests all the time that can help them with these menopausal symptoms, regardless of whether or not they choose to use hormone replacement therapy.
Michelle, that over 80% reduction in that study by Dr. Barnard, what was your personal experience?
So I was already eating a really healthy diet, but I did start to incorporate more soy based on the research around breast cancer survivorship, as well as the vasomotor symptoms. And so I would say I probably went from having maybe 5 to 8 hot flashes a day to now I would say probably about 1 a week or so. So I'm not sure, like I said, it's hard to kind of tease apart what was that acute menopausal transition phase, what was chemotherapy, but I feel so fortunate right now to be doing well and having very minimal symptoms.
And you mentioned the foods in his study. What else did you eat that you think made a difference?
So I do a smoothie every day. Looking at the literature around the power of leafy greens, the lutein and the zeaxanthin as far as brain health, and going through premature menopause, I know I have an increased risk for dementia. So I'm very, very mindful of doing all that I can to support my brain health. So I do a smoothie every day that has some kale or some spinach in it. I also add some blueberries, which is supportive of brain health. I do some ground flax seeds, which has the omega-3 fatty acids and some phytoestrogens as well. And then I usually use soy milk, which is wonderful because it has some protein in there as well, compared to like a cup or so of almond milk, which I think usually has about 1 gram of protein. Soy milk will usually have, I think, about 8 to 9 grams of protein. So I do my smoothies with soy milk. And then I kind of throw in whatever else I have around, maybe some mango or some other fruits. but I do a smoothie every day to get in those nutrients. Also, I'm mindful to get in some cruciferous vegetables, some really interesting research around cruciferous vegetables and their power to support women during the menopause transition as well as a breast cancer survivor. So I try to get in some broccoli sprouts or some broccoli or get my cruciferous vegetables every day. Also eating some fruits or some vegetables, a tomato. I try to get some tomato or orange vegetables in daily with the carotenoids. So just really a rainbow. A rainbow really is what a plant-based rainbow seems to support gut microbial health. It supports a healthy estrobolome, the estrogen metabolism, the bacteria that help with estrogen metabolism in the gut microbiome. So I really just try to nourish my microbiome with a lot of whole foods, with a lot of plants, with a lot of plant protein. There's research also showing that women who eat more plant protein usually have a decreased risk of dementia compared to women who eat more processed meat have a higher risk of dementia. Also, in addition to being a dementigen, processed meat is a carcinogen. So just another reason to stay away from that.
Yeah. And it's pretty amazing when you compare just this dietary component. I know we're going to talk about some of the other things that you did compared to some medications that are non-hormonal that we use to treat hot flashes for women who are not candidates for hormone replacement. And it doesn't even come close to that near 80% reduction. So that's really phenomenal.
Also, one of the things that I think is important for women to know as they go through the menopause transition is how the gut microbiome changes. As those trillions of bacteria in the gut, as a woman goes through menopause, there's a natural shift toward more inflammatory bacteria and a decrease in anti-inflammatory bacteria. So a healthy diet is important across the lifespan, but when a woman gets into her 40s, into that perimenopausal transition time, and then menopause and beyond, it is extra important that they're nourishing their gut microbiome with a variety of plants, with a lot of whole foods, avoiding or really limiting those ultra-processed foods to nourish their gut microbiome. Because we know that a nourished gut microbiome also helps to improve blood sugar stability, which is something that many women struggle with during the transition and beyond. Also, women become much more vulnerable to an increase in visceral fat or abdominal fat, which is the most inflammatory, dangerous kind of fat as they go through that menopause transition. And a healthy gut microbiome helps to decrease that visceral fat and calm down that inflammation. So diet, nutrition, eating nourishing whole foods is so important for women.
And I'm glad you touched on the changes in body composition, because I think next to hot flashes and sleep, probably the most common concern / complaint of a lot of women going through menopause is noticing the change in their body composition. And as you mentioned, your weight didn't change that much, but the distribution of the fat did change. And that's exactly, of course, what happens with menopause, where the fat redistributes centrally and around the abdomen. And the dietary piece, so everything you just mentioned can certainly help with the belly fat. What should people avoid to reduce the belly fat?
Yes. So just avoiding the foods that disrupt the gut microbiome. So avoiding ultra processed foods or foods with a lot of added sugar or salt, anything that's ultra processed where there's not a lot of fiber. So personally, I aim for at least 30 grams of fiber a day. I know our recommendation, the RDA, is a little bit lower than that. The average American woman gets about 12 grams a day, which is so low. But the American Institute for Cancer Research recommends at least 30 grams a day. So really emphasizing those foods that have fiber. And then that means limiting the foods that don't have a significant amount of natural fiber. So limiting those animal-based products, limiting the ultra-processed foods, the refined carbohydrates. I encourage women to go more toward the whole grains and not the refined grains. So choose the brown rice over the white rice, to eat things that, as Michael Pollan says, things that come from a plant that weren't made in a plant.
And the exercise piece, how much do people need to do? I mean, I think one of the hardest things is, as we all get older, it takes a lot more to not lose the muscle mass. And of course, we all work and have other responsibilities, and the amount of exercise is considerably, I think, more than what most people do. So what is a good target for exercise to negate some of the changes that happen from menopause?
Oh, great question. So anything is better than nothing. So think of wherever you're at and see if you can move in the direction of more movement. along that spectrum. But the recommendations are that women get 150 minutes of at least moderate intensity exercise per week spread throughout the week, and that they do some type of resistance training or muscle strengthening at least twice a week on days that are spread apart. And we know that when we look at accelerometer data in the middle and older aged women, only about 3% of women are actually meeting those guidelines when we look at accelerometer data. So we have huge room for improvement. But that movement is so important, and not just the aerobic activity, but that resistance training. As a woman is in her perimenopausal stage, so once again in her 40s, when women, most women are still menstruating, we start to see a doubling of the rate of fat mass gain and an increase in body mass index, as well as a significant decrease in lean muscle mass. And so it's not inevitable. It's just that women become much more vulnerable to that decrease in lean muscle mass. So resistance training becomes very important. Now, I've never been someone who gravitated toward the gyms or those resistance machines. I would do a little bit and then kind of stop. But after really diving into the research as a breast cancer survivor and a menopausal woman, I do not miss my physical activity time now. Like, it is scheduled into my routine every day. When I wake up, I get some aerobic activity in. Just earlier today, I was sitting for a prolonged period of time, and I get a reminder on my watch, and I do some exercise snacks. So I ran up and down my stairs 3 times, getting a little burst of physical activity to break up my sedentary time. And then I make sure that I get some resistance training in twice a week, whether that's going to the gym and doing some resistance machines. I also have the TRX straps at my house, so I'm able to do some of that body resistance and get in some resistance training that way. Planks can be beneficial as well. You can even use like cans for some resistance training. So there are a variety of different ways you can get it in. Another thing that I recommend for women is not to just go and try the resistance machines on your own. I recommend that you work with a professional who can really help you design a routine that's targeted for you. In fact, I told the physical therapist and then the personal trainer I worked with to put my routine together, I said, I do not want to lift weights for 1 minute more than I need to, but I want to do all that I can in order to improve my body composition and my health. And so they help put together a great routine that doesn't take too much time. But I think that that's critically important for women as they age to do that resistance training, because we know that that muscle is still receptive. It's just that it takes more of a stimuli in order to get that anabolic growth and to not lose that lean muscle mass. And then we also need to be getting enough protein, which is very doable too. You just have to be mindful of how much protein you're getting in.
Right. And I agree. I mean, I think a lot more people meet that exercise requirement for aerobic exercise than for strength resistance. I mean, we see this all the time. And I think appreciating just how much muscle mass is lost per decade on the order of 3-5%, that accompanies a strength loss that's closer to 10-15%. So if you extrapolate that, it's not just relevant to menopause, it's relevant to how we age, regardless of gender, of how much we essentially can't do so many leisurely activities fairly early on, like 60s, which I think is a very young age at that rate without the strength resistance. So it's so important. Are there principles behind the training regimen that your physical therapist and personal trainer put together? Like, are there some overarching just things that people should make sure they incorporate in their routine?
Yeah. So strengthening the core muscles, so the upper body as well as lower body, and then not forgetting about the core as well, which can be done just even with planks, but doing some different things that strengthen the core. That's also beneficial when we start to look at the pelvic floor, like with doing Kegels or tightening those muscles and releasing them to help strengthen the pelvic floor muscles. Having a stable core or a fit core helps us with that pelvic floor support as well. It's all just so beautifully intertwined. So getting in a variety of different activities, and then also making sure that you have adequate protein throughout the day, you know, snacking on an apple with some almond butter, or getting in some protein as well, which we can get plenty of protein from our plant protein, is important as well when you think about resistance training.
Yeah. And being very intentional about the protein, because I think by default, we tend to get enough carbs. I think,
oh, yes,
you know, at least that's my personal experience with trying to get what I need dietary standpoint. And for the strength resistance part, body resistance exercises, I think that that is so accessible for a lot of people. So when you don't have time to go to the gym, and to work, you know, with a trainer, et cetera, just how much you can do either using your body for push-ups, for sit-ups, planks, as you mentioned, they're probably underappreciated, just how much they do for strength resistance. So yeah, that's great. Michelle, you mentioned as part of that overarching principles of your routine pelvic floor. And when we were talking about all the menopause-related symptoms, we didn't talk so much about pelvic, you know, urologic changes, gynecologic changes. Can you talk a little bit more about menopause and genital and urinary health?
So after a woman goes through menopause and we see that significant decrease in estrogen, as we get further out from that time, usually about 3 years or so on out, we start to see what we call often genital urinary syndrome of menopause, or GSM, when that tissue gets thinner. So estrogen, we don't only have estrogen receptors in our uterus, we have estrogen receptors throughout our body. And that's why when we go through menopause, we often notice a thinning of a skin and the tissue in the vagina, as well as the urethra, the opening of the bladder to the outside world, those tissues are rich in estrogen receptors. And so when we see that decline in estrogen, those tissues get thinner and more fragile. We also see an increase in stress urinary incontinence, where a woman might like cough or sneeze and leak some urine. And so it can be beneficial for women to do what are called Kegels or pelvic floor muscle exercises in order to strengthen those muscles and to increase some of the blood flow to that tissue as well. And so I like women to imagine that they're trying to stop urinating and then they squeeze those muscles that they would use in order to stop urinating. We don't recommend that people do that regularly while urinating because that can lead to other problems, but they tighten those muscles and then release, and they can tighten them, count for a count of five, and then release for a count of five, and to do that several times during the day. I tell women it's a great idea to do them while they're watching TV. If a commercial comes on, they can use that as a signal to remember to tighten and relax those muscles. But pelvic health is very important. Also, I think we underestimate the impact of genital urinary syndrome of menopause on women's overall health. Genital urinary syndrome of menopause can be treated through topical estrogen because it's really that lack of estrogen that causes those significant changes. And topical estrogen does not have the same risk profile as does systemic hormone replacement therapy, or a patch or a pill where the hormone replacement therapy is going to all of the cells in the body. Of course, hormone replacement therapy, even vaginal, is not a good fit for everyone, but it should be something that they're able to discuss with their gynecologist or with their internist or family medicine doctor if they're noticing some of the vaginal dryness or itching or irritation or dyspareunia or painful intercourse. Those are things that we see that are very common. So we recommend that women consider using a moisturizer if they're noticing some vaginal dryness or irritation. First, reach out and see your doctor, but also there are products like Reverie, some different vaginal moisturizers that can be used, even just coconut oil, that can really help those tissues when used on a regular basis. Just like moisturizing our face regularly, it's a good idea to use a moisturizer if you're out from menopause or noticing any of that kind of vaginal dryness. And then lubricants can be used in order to help with sexual intercourse, with intimacy. Those lubricants can really help make intercourse less uncomfortable if somebody has genital urinary syndrome of menopause. So a variety of different ways that women can be helped. But there's so many women who just suffer in silence or think this is just part of aging, this is how it has to be, when really we have some great treatments that we can use that help many women. It's just important for them to go and talk to their doctor about it so that they can get help.
Yeah, and Michelle, that's a really good point, because I think that some women make the decision not to use hormone replacement therapy for various reasons and then don't really feel that there are other options for vaginal health and protecting against urinary tract infections, which we see a lot postmenopause, and discomfort with sexual intercourse, vaginal dryness, all that discomfort, and that the topicals, you know, the topical estrogen is viable for a lot of people who are not candidates for systemic hormones, including a lot of women who have gone through breast cancer treatments. Again, not for everybody, depending on the profile of the cancer, but certainly worthy of discussion, as you pointed out. So I think that's a really important point. With the pelvic floor, that's another really key area. I think the leakage is fairly disruptive for a lot of people. And the amount of, I guess, the pelvic floor exercises, you know, from the physical therapists that we work with, we see tremendous improvement. It's in some cases enough to avert, oftentimes it's enough to avert surgical interventions. Any thoughts or guidance around pelvic floor as a treatment for women who are experiencing the urinary incontinence?
So pelvic floor physical therapists are absolutely amazing. Again, too many women suffer in silence just thinking, well, I'm postmenopausal now, I'm supposed to leak. And it can't always be completely resolved. However, there's a lot that can be done. There are different options. Everything from sometimes just doing Kegel exercises or working with a pelvic floor physical therapist who can help with strengthening certain muscles. There's some different medications. And then there are surgical options. And a gynecologist or a urogynecologist, they do tremendous work with various surgical procedures that are often very much less invasive than some of our older surgeries. So I tell women, know your options. Go in and talk to your doctors. Get a referral for a consultation so that you can learn more about what's going on, know what your options are, and then decide how to move forward. But before an appointment, you can even start to keep a bladder diary. So keep track of how much liquid you take in for a few days, about how many times you're voiding or using the restroom during a day. You know, what are you drinking? Are you drinking a lot of caffeine? Are you drinking different things that are going to be more diuretics later at night? Is there a way that you can do some timed voiding? That's something that we often use that's an easy fix for some women. Some women, if they just time the times that they use the restroom, they're able to decrease that leakage. So there are a lot of different tips and tricks that we have. Once, as a physician, we know more about your problem, or a pelvic floor physical therapist, we're often able to give much more directed guidance that can significantly help women's quality of life when it comes to genitourinary problems.
Yeah, and I see that a lot. I think, like you said, that's what we call scheduled voiding, the just going to the bathroom every 2 hours for a couple weeks to train the bladder. Yes. For so many people, I think just we're in this busy pattern where we either don't urinate when we need to, or just try and maybe shave off a second or two when we are trying to, and it just forces the bladder and causes spasm. So just doing a little bit of bladder training oftentimes helps in just so many ways that we underappreciate these simple things. What other symptoms did you experience, and how did you work through other symptoms?
Yeah, so going through the menopause transition and trying to sort through what was chemotherapy and what was menopause, I noticed a significant decrease in energy. And we see that at about 25% of women prior to menopause will say that they are having problems with significant fatigue, all the way to about 85% of women post-menopause. And so a lack of energy or increased fatigue is a major problem. I think it's important for women to know that as they go through menopause, the mitochondria, which are those little, the powerhouse of the cells that you probably, well, of course, you know about them, but many of your listeners probably learned about in biology classes as well, that we have a decreased creation of new mitochondria, as well as the function of our mitochondria is not quite as robust as it used to be when we go through that menopause transition, if a woman is not getting adequate physical activity. With adequate physical activity, we actually have the creation of more new mitochondria, and the mitochondria that we have work better. And so that really helps with addressing fatigue for many women as well. We see that as physical activity increases, we see a dose response relationship with an increase in vitality and energy. And so I wasn't able to do a lot of movement during chemotherapy. I did some, but when I was done with chemotherapy, I really tried to increase my amount of physical activity. And I know that along with gaining some more lean muscle mass, that it also really improved my memory. Also with sleep, I think any of your listeners, if they had a new baby where they were sleep deprived or have gone through a time where they had very little sleep, the disruption of sleep with night sweats, even if a woman isn't fully cognitively aware that she's waking up at night, sometimes those night sweats can be enough to take her out of or decrease her amount of deep sleep. So really, really prioritizing my sleep was something that I did while in chemotherapy treatment and then beyond that I think really helped me as far as menopause symptoms. So it used to be that I would stay up a little bit later, maybe I watch an extra movie. And now I am very mindful of going to bed at a certain time, dimming the lights about an hour before I go to bed, getting the screens turned off, making sure that my dog sleeps outside of my bedroom, keeping my bedroom dark and a little bit cool and very quiet. So sleep is a priority to me being postmenopausal and being a cancer survivor, even more so than it was before. I'm really adamant about trying to get about 7 hours at least of sleep a night. We also know the research shows that about 7 hours or beyond when looking at brain scans of women of middle age and older, that we see the best mood. So that the most improved mood symptoms around 7 to 8 hours of sleep, we see the highest cortical thickness as well as the highest cortical volume in women who are sleeping about 7 to 8 hours a night. And we also see the highest fluid intelligence and fastest pair matching in women who are getting about 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night. So as far as decreasing the risk of dementia and also just helping with menopause symptoms and improving energy, I think it's so important for women to prioritize their sleep, to keep a regular sleep-wake schedule, and to really get into some good habits around sleep hygiene.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, sleep, I think, is the backbone of all of this. Without sleep, I think that it colors your entire day, you know. So I always think my day starts really at night with how I sleep. And then it kind of falls into place because, like you said, your recovery, whether you can exercise, all these variables are influenced by sleep. All of these things that you're talking about, you know, when you mentioned the mitochondria, I can't help but think these are happening with the background of us all getting older as we are going through menopause. So aging alone, of course, dramatically affects mitochondria in terms of number and efficiency, which impacts our energy levels and beyond, impacts our entire metabolic health, and you could argue every chronic disease. Also, you know, sleep architecture, our ability to get that good deep sleep, you know, like when we were teenagers, we can't quite do it the same way. So beyond the hormonal changes, there's so much that's happening just by virtue of getting older. And everything that you're mentioning, how important it is to really put an effort towards each of these components, towards the sleep and going through what you mentioned to get your bedroom just right and get you ready for sleep long before your head hits the pillow, are incredibly important. The sleep part, it's still such a challenge. I think a lot of people do what you just mentioned, you know, prepare the bedroom, try and unwind a little bit before they go to bed, but still wake up and their mind races and they still have a lot of trouble going right back to sleep despite putting effort into it. Do you have any advice for people who are really struggling with that?
Yeah, so I would encourage them to see their healthcare professional again. There's a lot of great research on cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia for women who are in the midlife and beyond. Also, a lot of really great research as far as exercise, physical activity interventions for women who are struggling with sleep. So that's one of the first things, if somebody's struggling with sleep, making sure that they're getting adequate physical activity, usually earlier in the day with their aerobic activity. And then if somebody is still struggling, I recommend that they connect with a health professional. There's, I guess, too much undiagnosed sleep apnea and other different sleep conditions. And then also, I think a lot of people are like, oh, I don't want to take a medication for sleep. And I know that those medications have a place. However, like cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, which includes a lot of the sleep hygiene recommendations, can be so powerful. So go see your healthcare provider, reach out and learn more about cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia if you're struggling with insomnia symptoms, because there is, once again, help available. I think so many women just say, well, you know, I'm menopausal now, and so I know I won't sleep well, and I know I'll leak urine, and I know that I'll have vaginal dryness. And so it's really kind of seeing that there's a different way to age. In the United States, as far as life expectancy for women, we rank 42nd. But what's even more troublesome is our healthy life expectancy. We rank 83rd globally, according to World Health Organization data, as far as healthy life expectancy. And so I really want my patients to understand that there's a different way to age. I want them to think of their trajectories. So it's not just about what they're doing now. Like if somebody wants to be, I want to be traveling when I'm 80 and 90 years old, and I want to be able to take that suitcase and lift it up. I want to be able to play with my grandkids I hope to have someday. And so they need to be thinking about, are the lifestyle behaviors that I'm engaging in now going to lead to a trajectory of health, or are they more likely to lead to a health trajectory of disease? Now, we can't control everything, but we can control so much. And so I encourage people to think about, are their lifestyle behaviors putting them on a trajectory where they are at a higher likelihood of having that long-term health? Because aging does not have to be what it stereotypically is for so many women in the United States who live a good 12 years of their life, often on average, with chronic disease and things that significantly limit their quality of life.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think looking at the trajectory is so important, because I think right now, the number one cause of disability is really disuse, and we can do so much better. So I will make that a challenge to the people listening, that I think we can live a very different life as we get older. Michelle, for people who want to know more, can you tell us about the Paving a Woman's Path Through Menopause and Beyond?
I would love to. So when I finished chemotherapy, it was Valentine's Day. I finished chemotherapy and I joined a survivorship group. And it was one of the most depressing experiences I've ever had, being part of this breast cancer survivorship group. So I dropped out, probably not the best thing to do, but I said, I'm not going back to that. And I told my dear friend and colleague, Dr. Beth Frades, that I had dropped out of this cancer survivorship group. And a silver lining of the pandemic is that Dr. Amy Commander started the Paving the Path of Wellness for Breast Cancer Survivors group out in Boston. And they were going online because of the pandemic. So Dr. Beth Frades created the program initially for stroke survivors. Dr. Amy Commander modified it for breast cancer survivors. And I thought, I don't need another survivorship group. I already know about nutrition. I've done this before. And Dr. Frades said, just try. And I love Beth. And I said, okay, I'll try anything. And then I met Dr. Amy Commander, who's absolutely fabulous. And in addition to learning more about nutrition and physical activity and stress management and sleep and social connection, the pillars of the Paving the Path to Wellness program that really impacted me the most were looking at attitude. What's the science around attitude and self-compassion and a growth mindset and my self-talk? How does that influence my well-being? Looking at how I can incorporate variety and investigation and goal setting to really optimize my well-being. And then looking at energy, which was huge. Energy management, what natural things gave me energy and what drained my energy, both physically and mentally and emotionally. And then last but definitely not least was the pillar or the dimension of purpose. And so really diving into the literature around purpose really significantly impacted my life. So when I was done being part of that program for breast cancer survivors, I told Dr. Commander and Dr. Frades, what can I do to help get this to others? Because I felt so fortunate as a breast cancer survivor that I had access to this, but I know that so many women don't. And so that's why I partnered with them to help support or co-author the Paving the Path to Wellness workbook. And then because of all the different menopause changes, we decided that we needed to write a book focused on menopause. So Paving a Woman's Path Through Menopause and Beyond, Dr. Commander and Dr. Frades are my co-authors for that book as well. And now we have a nonprofit called Paving the Path to Wellness. It's a 501c3 nonprofit organization. All of the proceeds from the books go directly to that nonprofit. And our goal is to get not just breast cancer survivors, but to get everyone access to the Paving the Path to Wellness program. So that, as Dr. Frades says, we can live with a healthier body, a more peaceful heart, and a more joyful mind now and for decades to come.
That's fabulous. Well, Michelle, thank you so much for sharing all this information and being willing to share your personal experience and your journey, because I think that really helps put it in perspective for a lot of people going through the same. And thank you for this great information and the resource through the program that you have all created.
Of course. No, it's great to be able to share it with the community.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and share it with a friend. Until next time, do something to help improve your whole health naturally.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.